the full CIA, NSA-developed suite of tools that now have made it into the hands of local law enforcement in this country are most certainly trained on those activists and their supporters.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for being with us, Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of The Intercept, where his most recent article is headlined, Mike Pence Will Be the Most Powerful Christian Supremacist in U.S. History. That does it for today's show. We'll be celebrating Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary with Harry Belafonte, Noam Chomsky, Patti Smith, and more this December 5th in New York City. Visit democracynow.org for details. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thank you for listening.
First, and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KABU. Thank you.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kabu.org.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, laurelhursttheater.com.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent and classic films, microbrews, pizzas, and salads, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland. More information can be found online at laurelhursttheater.com. Coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the United Nations Security Council met today to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict in Syria.
Student demonstrators gathered at Holiday Park here in Portland earlier this afternoon to march against the nomination of Donald Trump for president.
And Standing Rock water protectors were attacked last night with water cannons, tear gas, and rubber bullets, injuring more than 160 people. We bring you a report from the scene.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, November 21st, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Last night in North Dakota, police attacked Standing Rock water protectors with mace, projectiles, water cannons, sound cannons, and concussion grenades. The incident began at about 6 p.m. when water protectors were attempting to peacefully remove two military-style vehicles that had been blocking Highway 1806 in an effort to clear the path for emergency service vehicles. National Lawyers Guild legal observers on the scene reported that the attack resulted in 167 injuries, including mass hypothermia, at least one cardiac arrest, and one seizure. At least 20 people were sent to the emergency room with serious injuries. A 13-year-old girl was shot in the face with a rubber bullet, and one woman had her kneecap broken. For more on the story, KBOO reporters Jenna Yokoyama and Kanan Schlesinger spoke with Christopher Francisco, who's on the scene in North Dakota.
It continued all night long. I got shot with a beanbag in my thigh, so I couldn't stay there anymore because I was totally wet. You know, they were shooting that water cannon on me, and my whole clothes were frozen already, so I couldn't stay out. And a lot of people, you know, they try hanging on, and they passed out, you know, blankets, and they passed out gloves, hats, warm clothing, food, and medics were everywhere, you know, trying to help people, you know, that were maced in the face. Some people were shot in the stomach with beanbags and stuff, and one guy couldn't breathe, and I think another female got shot with a flash grenade at close range. It blew up right close to her, and she had to go to the hospital in Minneapolis from what I hear. I didn't see it, though. I was mostly, like, to the roadside along the barbed wire. That's where I was doing shooting video, and pretty much action was going on all over the place. You know, there's one over on the other side of the road, and there was one in the middle where the water canyon was, and people were standing behind the burned out vehicle, and I was to the right side. And so they started, this one guy from where I was standing, he just really freaked out. He started cussing, and he just started, you know, blasting at people, and there was like tracers or shooting some kind of tracers, and people were trying to hide, you know, they're trying to hide and they're trying to lay down, and there was no place to run. We're up in an open field. So I had to start walking because they were just like shooting people, man. It's like sooner or later, you're just going to get hit, and you just have to like hold, you know, they finally shot me while I was walking back to the road. We had no choice because they're just blasting people.
For KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
Nonviolent activists in support of the water protectors at Standing Rock traveled to a regional Army Corps of Engineers official for an action today. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with a grassroots activist who goes by the name of Turtle about what happened.
Today, 24 people went to the home of one of the key decision makers of the Army Corps of Engineers. We went as people of faith to pray for the Army Corps of Engineers, to pray for that individual, to pray for the water, to pray for the water protectors at Standing Rock. And we really went there to offer a closer connection. There's just such a big distancing that happens when we think about organizations and institutions and projects instead of recognizing that we are individuals with hearts and spirits.
What happened? What happened when you were there?
We went to his home and we sang and we passed around a jar of water. And each of us prayed with the water, and that was part of what we offered him, because all water is sacred water, all water is holy water, and we wanted him to understand that. And, you know, it was quite a simple action in the spirit of the prayerful actions that are happening at Standing Rock. Our message is just really simple, that we're praying for clean water for all the future generations, and we pray that the children that are just coming up now will look back at this time and recognize that we cared so much about them, and we all made choices with deep integrity, and we protected the water for them.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Mm-hmm. The Human Rights Council of Washington County has created an email for the purpose of collecting data regarding incidents of harassment or violence based on hate. KABU reporter John Shuck has more on the story.
I am speaking with Rob Solomon. He's the president of the Human Rights Council of Washington County. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, a little bit about the Human Rights Council. When did it start and what are the things you do?
Well, the Human Rights Council in Washington County started roughly 10 years ago. A group of really good people got together. Originally, the catalyst was the Vision Action Network here in Washington County. They determined that there were some things going on that people weren't taking a look at and wanted to see if they could start an organization that would help. Over the years, we've had some changes. We've had different populations to our group, and we've learned a lot. What have we done? We do listening sessions. We go into communities to encourage people to talk about what's going on, because we're an educational organization, and we believe strongly that it's only when things are hidden that things are going to get worse. The only way we can help things to get better is if we promote the awareness and promote dialogue.
Now, is there a connection then with the government of Washington County?
No. I mean, we work with them. They know we exist and we communicate with them. But frankly, governmental organizations are sometimes hampered by their own rules. It's difficult sometimes to speak out when you're immersed in the world of politics. Our independence gives us an opportunity to be more of an advocacy organization.
So you're a nonprofit group then?
We are registered nonprofit 501c3 status as of just a few months ago, actually.
And a press release just came out from you about a new email that you put out in terms of receiving, if people receive acts of violence or hate. Tell us a little bit about this new email.
Sure. It was really hard for us to keep our eyes closed when we hear things like 6 days after the federal election, there were 400 incidents reported just in the first 6 days, not even a week, 400 incidents throughout the country of hate, violent-related things that, you know, you can't necessarily say are directly related to the election, but some of them are pretty clear. And 19 of those 400 happened in Oregon. It seems to me that that's more than our share. And what we wanted to do is work with the police, and we've got their support in this, to set up a way to report crimes and harassment that some folks might not feel comfortable talking to law enforcement directly. If someone calls us, we will encourage, or emails us rather, we will encourage them to also report to the authorities. But sometimes people just don't trust the authorities based on some of their own backgrounds. And sometimes they don't think they have enough evidence to report to authorities. The authorities still want those reports, and we want them to have that information, but we don't want to lose information. We want to make sure we have as much awareness and share it as we possibly can. We will not publish names. We will take anonymous reports and identify them as such. We are not interested in publishing names, either sharing them with law enforcement if the person who is a victim doesn't wish to. We just want to make sure that there is some place in Washington County where as much information is collected as possible.
So what will you do then with these emails?
With the emails, they will be kept confidential. But the data, which will be the nature of the incident, the time and location that it took place, they will be published on a list on our website for the public to be able to check any time. And also it'll be coordinated with the police so that the police will also have that same information and know about areas to be able to watch, to monitor, things like that. And in addition, of course, to their own reports.
And the email went up on November 17th, as I understand. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Have you received any reports since then?
Actually, that's an interesting question. No, we received one the day or two beforehand, which is what stimulated us. That one has already been reported to the media. An African-American woman was assaulted in a parking lot around 185th out here in Washington County.
So have you received other reports besides that one in Washington County, that not necessarily to the email, but that people had heard?
No, a little bit of anecdotal reports in some meetings we've had, especially related to kids in school being identified as being a member of a given minority and being told to, quote, go home where they came from, unquote, which in my to my way of thinking is harassment and hurtful, but again, it doesn't constitute the nature of report. The council is really pleased that we're ready to receive these reports, and we'll take thousands of them if they come in. Quite frankly, we're hoping to never receive a report at all.
Right. So if thousands, so who is running the email?
Well, actually, the president is. So I'm running it until, pardon me, I'm running it at least for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Rob Solomon, president of the Human Rights Council of Washington County, is who I'm speaking with. And so the follow-up to these, would someone sent an email, would you email them back?
Yes, we will acknowledge the email, and we will also ask them, if they haven't already told us, if they've reported to the appropriate enforcement agency, you know, Hillsborough Police, if it happens in Hillsborough, if it's in the unincorporated county, to the sheriff's office. We've also connected through the sheriff to the chiefs as well, and they've indicated a willingness to send us the information and receive information from us as well.
And is this only for instances in Washington County?
Yes, by all means. There are other resources nationally and in other areas. We're only concerned with Washington County right now.
And what is that email?
It's reports at hrcwc.org.
And the website?
The website, it's a little lengthy. We're sorry about that, but it's www.humanrightscouncilofwashingtoncounty.org. That's all one word.
And people certainly would be able to Google Human Rights Council of Washington County and find it.
And it should darn well come up, yes.
And one more time with that email.
That email to report any incidents of harassment or hate crime would be reports at hrcwc.org.
And Rob Solomon, one more question. What is ultimately the goal of this? What do you hope to accomplish by having this email out for the residents of Washington County?
We want as many folks in Washington County who will have their eyes open to be as fully aware as possible so they can watch, they have a place to report, and we can hopefully do our best through the awareness to minimize the number of these awful events that could happen.
All right. Rob Solomon, president of the Human Rights Council of Washington County. I'm John Shuck for KBOO.
Student demonstrators gathered at Holiday Park at 4 p.m. today to march against the nomination of Donald Trump for president. An excerpt from their webpage states, "We cannot and will not allow the normalization of racism, misogyny, xenophobia, Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, and ableism that the president-elect has come to embody." Portland Resistance aided the students in organizing the protest and to ensure the safety of the students while they are exercising their rights. The head of Portland Resistance, Gregory McKelvey, stated that whether that has to do with being beaten or arrested by the cops or with outside agitators, but that's one of the reasons that we're there, to help keep everybody safe. TriMet says to expect delays along all MAX lines and bus lines that are in that area during the protest, which the police expect to be peaceful.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report featuring two live in-studio interviews on disaster relief for Haiti and the film Lion Ark, which is premiering in Portland tonight. At 6, it's Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and challenging the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, views and news from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, 10% chance of rain after 5 a.m., areas of fog after 11 p.m., otherwise mostly cloudy, low around 43. Tomorrow, rain, mainly after 11 a.m., and areas of fog before 11 a.m., high near 51. Chance of precipitation is 90%. Today in history, in 1906, the Imperial Government of China issued a decree to eliminate the consumption of and trade in opium. And in 1973, President Richard Nixon's personal attorney, Fred Buzhardt, revealed that there was an 18-and-a-half-minute gap in one of the White House Watergate tapes. The quote of the day is from the late President John F. Kennedy, who said, "I sometimes think that we're too much impressed by the clamor of daily events. The newspaper headlines and the television screens give us a short view. They so flood us with the stop press details of daily stories that we lose sight of one of the great movements of history. Yet it's the profound tendencies of history and not the passing excitements that will shape our future."
President-elect Donald Trump has tapped Representative Mike Pompeo, a Kansas Republican, as the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Pompeo has been a polarizing figure in Congress, falsely stating in 2013 that the silence of Muslim leaders has been deafening in the weeks following the deadly bombing of the Boston Marathon. FSRN's Jacob Resnick spoke to the former CIA analyst Melvin Goodman about Trump's apparent choice.
We'll start with a general question about the CIA itself. Over the years, it's grown in its scope and mission. So what exactly is the CIA that the Trump administration will be inheriting?
Well, the Trump administration will be inheriting a central intelligence agency that has become essentially a paramilitary organization. And when the CIA was formed by President Harry Truman in 1947, it was designed as an intelligence collection and intelligence analysis agency. It was designed to provide objective and balanced intelligence to the President of the United States and the major members of the President's policy team. But over the years, the CIA has indulged in politicization of intelligence. This was particularly true in the 1980s when William Casey and Robert Gates politicized the intelligence on the Soviet Union. But the worst example of this, of course, came about in 2002-2003 when the CIA supported George W. Bush's decision to go to war against Iraq and actually tailored and manufactured, created intelligence out of whole cloth. So this is an agency that has politicized intelligence. The other problem with the CIA that the Trump team will inherit is this paramilitary aspect. Many of its recruits now are from the military. The CIA has essentially been running the drone program in some areas of the world. There's been far too much covert action, which has in most cases failed and in many cases embarrassed the United States and the CIA itself. So this is the group that really is the leading agency within an intelligence community that spends about $60 billion a year, more than the rest of the world spends on intelligence, and has an incredible global reach.
Representative Mike Pompeo has been described as an ideologue, a hawkish member of Congress. Given his record as a lawmaker and his time spent on the House Intelligence Committee, what do we know about his views on such controversial matters as drone assassinations, waterboarding, and other forms of torture?
Well, when you look at the various elements of the CIA's role in the global war on terror, which have included things like torture and abuse and secret prisons and extraordinary renditions, and the ability of Barack Obama to end a lot of these practices, closing the secret prisons, ending torture and abuse, Obama hasn't completely ended renditions, but I think there are very much fewer of them than there were before. Pompeo has objected to all of this. He's objected to the closing of the prisons. He wants to keep Guantanamo open, something that Obama wanted to do in terms of closing Guantanamo. So all of the activities that the CIA engaged in that were in many cases immoral activities, illegal activities, and violations of the Constitution in terms of the Eighth Amendment against torture and abuse, these are the things that Pompeo defends. And his behavior on the Benghazi committee that examined Hillary Clinton and that determined that Hillary Clinton was not responsible for the aftermath of the killings in Benghazi. You have to remember that Pompeo issued his own 48-page annex that only one other member of the committee, but not the chairman of the committee, was willing to sign. So this is a hardliner. This is an ideologue. This is an extremely partisan and pugnacious individual. To me, this is not the kind of individual you want to see running a central intelligence agency that is controversial enough. And the last time a president reached into the House of Representatives for a director, it was George W. Bush who picked Porter Goss. And that was a disaster at the CIA. And before 2 years were up, Porter Goss had to be removed from the position. So you look at the Trump appointments of not only Pompeo, but Sessions as Attorney General and Mike Flynn as the National Security Advisor, and you realize that all of the things that Trump talked about in the campaign in terms of immigration and what he would do with regard to Muslims in the United States and the use of American force in places such as the Middle East, he's putting people into place that agree with those positions.
I don't know if you're a betting man, but as any Trump appointment for CIA director will need to be approved by the U.S. Senate, how do you rate his chances of being confirmed on Capitol Hill?
Well, I am a betting man, and he'll have no problems on the Hill. Pompeo will go through easily. There will be some Democratic opposition, but the Democrats have not proven to be extremely forceful and energetic in taking positions in contrast to the positions of the Republican Party, for example. So I expect him to be confirmed easily.
Melvin Goodman, thank you for speaking with FSRN.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Melvin Goodman was a CIA analyst for 24 years and ran the Soviet Union desk for a decade. He's an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he's also the author of several books, including the forthcoming title, Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. He spoke to FSRN from Bethesda, Maryland. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Over the weekend, anti-Semitic, xenophobic, and white nationalist fervor filled the walls of a private dining room in a secret meeting that the alt-right called in an Italian restaurant. The ideological core of the so-called alt-right movement gathered a few blocks away from the White House to discuss their emerging influence on the Trump administration in front of a crowd of over 200 people consisting of mostly white men. The final speaker of the nearly 11-hour conference was Richard B. Spencer, who heads the National Policy Institute and who also claims to have coined the name alt-right for the movement. He appealed to the audience by describing them as children of the sun and described white America as an oppressed, downtrodden group and one whose time of redemption is soon at hand. Spencer invoked Nazi-era cultural references, including an expression that means, in the original German, as he put it, the lying press. Spencer ended his speech by saluting white nationalism and Donald Trump with what very closely resembled a Nazi salute. As a warning to our listeners, the following audio clip from Spencer's speech might be disturbing.
This is a unique burden for the white man, that our fate is entirely in our hands. And it is appropriate because within us, within the very blood in our veins, as children of the sun, lies the potential for greatness. That is the great struggle we are called to. We are not meant to live in shame and weakness and disgrace. We were not meant to beg for moral validation from some of the most despicable creatures to ever populate the planet. We were meant to overcome all of it, because that is natural and normal for us. Because for us as Europeans, it is only normal again when we are great again. Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
That was alt-right ideologue Richard Spencer speaking over the weekend to a group of white nationalists in Washington, D.C. Though it's not yet explicitly stated in most media sources, the ties between Trump, his senior advisor appointee Richard Bannon, and openly white supremacist alt-right demagogues like Richard Spencer seem to be drawing closer and more intense as Inauguration Day on January 20th approaches.
The United Nations Security Council met today to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict in Syria. the Emergency Relief Coordinator for Syria from the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Stephen O'Brien, updated the Security Council on the situation there. In addition to the numbers, O'Brien spoke to the Council about his growing frustration with nations on all sides of the conflict.
Since last Tuesday, the bombing of eastern Aleppo has not stopped. Over the past days, reports indicate that hundreds of civilians have been killed, injured, or otherwise affected by the relentless attacks on eastern Aleppo. Entire families were reported to have been buried under rubble in the Al-Sakari district as first responders searched for survivors. Fires raged from incendiaries and household gas breaches in residential buildings following the attacks, which stretched throughout eastern Aleppo. Deaths were reported in at least 10 neighborhoods. As of yesterday, there are barely any functional hospitals left in eastern Aleppo able to treat those who have escaped death, as all the hospitals are being bombed into oblivion. In parallel, more than 350 mortars and rockets have been reportedly launched by non-state armed groups indiscriminately into western Aleppo since the 1st of November, killing over 60 people, including women and children, and injuring more than 350 more. Over the weekend, an attack on a school in the Al-Furqan district in western Aleppo with mortar shells and rocket projectile by non-state armed groups reportedly killed 8 children and injured several others, while the local university was also hit. Overall, some 25,000 people have been displaced in western Aleppo in the last few weeks as a result of shelling by non-state armed groups. Let me be clear. We are not just seeing a resumption of violence in Aleppo. This is not business as usual. What has been unleashed on civilians this past week is yet another low in an unrelenting, inhuman onslaught. And it is as heartbreaking as it is not inevitable. These parties to the conflict are, all of them, choosing to do this. It is civilians who pay the price. Mr. President, attacks on civilian infrastructure, most notably hospitals and schools, have become so commonplace it takes your breath away. Such attacks are violations of international humanitarian law. Some have been called out as war crimes by the Secretary General, including again yesterday. And the High Commissioner for Human Rights has indicated that some may even amount to crimes against humanity. They are senseless, unconscionable acts with no purpose other than to punish civilians, including women, children, and the infirm, and deny those left behind with the means to survive or rebuild. Millions of Syrian children have had their childhoods ripped away by calculated and reckless attacks on schools. In the last 2 weeks of October alone, the lives and dreams of 30 children were stolen during attacks on 5 schools. On 26th of October, the very day of my last briefing, when denials were screeching through the air, 22 children and 6 of their teachers were killed when their school compound was repeatedly attacked in Haas, Idlib Governorate. But the facts are that the kids and their teachers are dead. Death, a dead body, warm to cold blood, however hard anyone may try, death is an undeniable fact, and there is always a cause of death. Imagine the terror of those children. Imagine those who may have survived the first strike, some hysterical, some frozen in fear, only to see another round coming in. Mr. President, this year, UNICEF has documented 84 attacks on schools, killing at least 69 children and injuring many more. So, Mr. President and members of the Council, I have had little positive to report on the implementation of the resolutions of this Council as regards the humanitarian situation in Syria. Airstrikes and shelling kill and injure more and more civilians, and protected civilian infrastructure is destroyed with implications that will resonate for years to come. Besiegement is increasing. People are going hungry. Schools and hospitals are being bombed. The United Nations is increasingly blocked from delivering to those most in need. And most frustratingly, this human suffering is all unnecessary. There is no amount of suffering that will result in an end to the conflict. There is no amount of military operations that will see an end to the conflict. The only solution, as has been said countless times before, is a political solution. There are people here at this table and beyond with the influence to tell the Syrian government we are not prepared to take no for an answer. If you are a petrified civilian patient in Aleppo tonight, you don't need to hear your own government pray national sovereignty in aid to justify using that sovereignty to bomb its own people and that patient.
That was Stephen O'Brien, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, speaking to the Security Council on the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in Syria.
Animal Defenders International, or ADI, is previewing a major film tonight about the struggle to save circus lions trapped in the nation of Bolivia, where a law banning the wildcats was being ignored. The film, called Lion Ark, plays tonight right here in Portland at the Regal Fox Tower as part of a nationwide roadshow. Here to talk about the film and the effort to rescue the circus animals is Jan Creamer, president of ADI and producer of the film Lion Ark, and Tim Phillips, vice president of ADI and the director of the film. Jan and Tim, thanks very much for coming into KBOO this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting us.
Jan, let's start with you first. Before we got into the film, I wanted listeners to learn a little bit about your organization, Animal Defenders International, maybe a little bit about its history and its mission.
Absolutely. Animal Defenders International was started in 1990. Tim and I had been campaigning for animals separately with different organizations for many years. And we realized that there was a need to have an organization that connected all of the different campaigns. At the time, people perhaps were concerned about meat eating or factory farming, but not concerned about the environment. And that compartmentalization of the things that everybody cared about meant that we weren't really making much progress. And so the concept of ADI is that we join the dots, and it's all about animals and the environment. So it's wildlife conservation, global warming, the way we treat the other species that share our planet. And this campaign that we're focusing on the moment is about the way we treat animals that are captive, that are held by humans.
So the film, we're talking about basically just one facet of this organization, and that's concentrating on rescuing circus animals, which I'd like to get to now. The film's fascinating. Again, it's called Lion Ark, premiering, even though you've had roadshow in other areas of the world and the U.S. tonight in Portland. What happened in Bolivia with the lions, and how did you first learn about it?
The whole campaign started in about 2002. Tim and I were at a CITES meeting in Chile, Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, which is a very grand conference that they hold every 2 years, and they have their balls and all of their discussions and debates about whether the other species that share our planet should live or die. And during one of the events, we were told that there was a chimpanzee, which is a CITES I listed species, in a circus half an hour away from a meeting of about 170 governments were meeting and talking about these species. And there's one in a circus just half an hour away.
Did you guys kind of each get into a cab and hop over there? Or?
We absolutely did.
Went straight there. I was just joking, but...
No, we went straight there. We filmed and photographed Toto. We started a campaign for Toto to be freed, and eventually we got him back to Africa. We got him back to Zambia. All of the other babies that had been stolen with him had died. He was the lone survivor. He'd been alone for 20 years, and we reintroduced him to other chimpanzees. And it set South America alight in terms of animal issues and animal campaigns, animal rights. People were absolutely set alight by it and realized it was something that they really needed to do. And that started our whole campaign. We sent undercover investigators to work in all of the circuses all over South America for about 2 years. And then we released the evidence. And about five countries decided to ban animal circuses.
Including Bolivia.
Including Bolivia. They got there first.
Were they all South American countries at this point?
They were. There are about 34 bans all over the world. We've worked in Europe, the US, Asia, all over the world. But this really set the campaign alight in South America. Five countries banned very quickly. And since then, it's about another three or four. Mexico, El Salvador have been the most recent.
Now, we'll go from Toto the chimpanzee to the lions here. There were 25 lions that you rescued in Bolivia. That's what the film kind of documents. First, how were the lions captured for the circus, and what are their lives like once they're captured and kind of paraded out to these audiences?
It's a pretty desperate life for these animals. They were originally stolen from Africa, brought across to the US, usually Florida, and then sold down to the circuses. And this is generations of animals suffering extreme deprivation. It's not just the day-to-day brutality, but they're living on bare boards and bare bars. It's the kind of deprivation and isolation that we know causes so much damage to any species, any intelligent feeling species. And, you know, you even look at the way people are treated when they're abused and, you know, when they're isolated and imprisoned, and you see those same kinds of behaviors in animals.
We're all social animals, and when we're isolated like that, the mind doesn't quite work the right way.
Absolutely.
And true with animals and people. Now Bolivia, we mentioned that they had a law to ban circus animals, but apparently that was being ignored when you made the rescue. The circuses just didn't care, or it wasn't enforced?
Yeah, that's right. We secured the law in 2009, and one circus obeyed the law and handed over its animals to ADI, which was a baboon and a group of lions, and everybody else defied the law. So over a year later, we tracked down all of those circuses, and that's very much where the film Lion Art begins, chasing down these circuses all over Bolivia. It's a big, big country, about the size of Texas and California combined, and it's a very remote country, and these circuses, some of them were, you know, 1,000 miles apart. So we tracked down about 8 different circuses. We raided them. The film actually focuses on the lions and saving them, but we rescued every single animal. We rescued horses.
Elephants? And
There weren't any elephants. Oh. There were monkeys and various other animals. And then we rehabilitated them and took the lions home to Colorado, in fact.
Now, Tim, you're the director, and I read about all the challenges you had in making the film, and you mentioned that Bolivia wasn't the most hospitable place for a filmmaker. How did you decide to document this story there? You mentioned small towns and the distances of 1,000 miles or so between circuses.
Well, we set out to film it. We knew that no one had ever attempted an operation like this, to go to a country and enforce such a strong ban. And ADI, what we do is we go to countries where there are no resources to do these types of operation. And really, animal welfare laws around the world, they're often secured, but the biggest issue is nearly always enforcement. You look at the ivory trade, you look at animal trafficking, and you look at anti-cruelty laws like this. The laws are secured, and if they're ignored, they're worthless. So we set out to actually enforce this, and we knew that no one had attempted to build a holding center from scratch, go out, find the circuses and raid them. And so we thought this should be documented. And then as it unfolded, it just was this incredible story, and we were able to sort of track the transformation of the lives of these animals. It doesn't pull its punches, Lion Art, but it's a really uplifting story, because you see these animals go from these bare wooden and metal boxes to running about, being reunited with their own kind. And it's that transformation that tells you how wrong it is to deprive these animals.
Now, it's not giving too much away. I think you just did that. It does have a happy ending. Where were the lions sent to? What kind of sanctuary, and where was it located?
These lions go to a sanctuary in Colorado. And the monkeys went to safe places in Bolivia. And what we aim to do is look for the homes that are going to best suit these animals. We try and replicate as closely as possible what nature intended, because you're sending a big message when you go to these countries and say, these animals aren't being looked after correctly. We want to set a very, very high standard. In fact, I feel we've gone beyond that with the mission we've just finished a few months ago in Peru, where we managed to put every single animal back in its natural habitat. So that was bears back to the cloud forest, monkeys back to the Amazon. And this time we've flown 33 lions all the way home to Africa.
Is that Operation Spirit of Freedom?
That's the one, yes.
And you'll be talking a little bit about that tonight in addition to showing the movie.
We will, absolutely, yes. And one of the key messages, and we talk about that at the beginning of Lion Ark, and we pick up on it again when we talk about Spirit of Freedom, is that this is about the animals, yes, but it's also about us. You know, our attitude, the way we behave as a species to the rest of the species that share our planet. This is their home too. They don't look like us. They don't speak like us. They don't communicate as we do. But we treat them as they are nothing because they look and differently and behave differently and live in a different way. So this is as much about us as a species and the way we behave towards the other species as anything else. And I think in Spirit of Freedom, that was one of the things that we wanted to demonstrate to people, that these animals belong where nature intended. They've evolved in these areas, and they do have a right to life. They have the right to be happy and to do the things that they want to do where they were meant to be.
Oh, Jan and Tim, one last question. And again, thanks for coming into KBOO. For KBOO listeners who can't make it to the movie tonight, how can they support the cause of ADI and maybe even get a copy of the film for themselves?
Well, if they check out our websites, they can go to lionarkthemovie.com. They can buy a copy of the video there. They can also go to ad-international.org. That's the Animal Defenders website. You can also follow us on Facebook. The film shows that we're a very empowering group. We want people to get involved and make a difference. This is a story of how a small group of people pulled together and transformed a country. And it can happen here. It can happen all over the world.
Oh, again, thanks very much for coming into KBOO with that movie. And there's still time to get there because Jan and Tim have to get there. It's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Regal Fox Tower Stadium 10. That's downtown Portland, 846 Southwest Park Avenue. And you can get tickets online or just come on down and you can see the film.